I'm Alvin Pitcher, and my colleague is Sarah Pitcher. Sarah is very active in our church, particularly in our Central American work. She's also on the staff of our youth service organization, which has somewhat over $300,000 budget and is a part of the mission of the church. What we're trying to do this week, and have been trying to do since we've been here, is to talk about the body of Christ. Talk about the image of the body coming out of Corinthians 12 through 26, where it is asserted by Paul that life in the church is like life in a body, where when one cares for another, one experiences the joys and the sufferings of the other. This image is an organic image, and it's quite different from the image that is characteristic of much of our thinking in contemporary America. We're trying to come out of that and explain and illustrate how a local church can take that image seriously. And we've talked about our intentional Christian community, a community of about 60 people, and what it's trying to do. We've talked about how our church has handled the problem of being the body, black and white. We've talked about how the church has tried to be the body with both a middle class and an underclass membership or activity that tries to include them. And we've tried to illustrate, and we'll be doing that today, how we attend to the world outside of ourselves. And I'm a minister of the church with assignment for social ministries 10 hours a week for 9 months of the year, and without a salary. And one thing we want to illustrate is what can happen if the senior minister of a church will permit it. What can happen with lay leadership? We started in 1983 a study group on Central America. We call it the Christian, the Church and Foreign Policy. We decided to work on Central America. We worked on Central America and the nuclear issues. And we became a sanctuary church and a nuclear weapons free zone church. All of this activity has taken place with lay leadership. And finally, we got considerable support from our senior minister, as you will see in the film. But we took the lead. And it's not something maybe that your church can do, but this is simply a confession and a kind of description of what one local church has tried to do in becoming the body of Christ. And today we'll see a film which depicts the activity of the church. It's made by a professional filmmaker, and the videotape is available for you if you want to use it in your church. With that, I think, unless you have something, Sarah.
Well, I just want to say that the title, Jean is a member of our church that made the tape, too. She is a professional tape or filmmaker, but she also is a member of our congregation. And she wanted to entitle it, and you'll see it just a little bit, but I don't think people sometimes pick up on it. It is about one church's decision-making and discussion about becoming sanctuary, but she titles it, "You Are One of Us?" And that wanted to say that that comes out of, we have, when new people come into our congregation, our welcoming ceremony is, we welcome you, Jody, you are one of us. We welcome you, Sarah, you are one of us. And that is part of our membership, coming into membership in our church. So the fact that she put this in is a statement on her part, you are one of us, And I think that really is something to think about in terms of what sanctuary means, what it means to bring it. And we had this was made, a Guatemalan family that had just come.
Seeing such energy like this, since the late 60s.
How's that?
That's remarkable energy. And there are people who are running this.
We are now in the third year, and there are over 235 publicly declared St. Francis congregations, Roman Catholic, Protestant, Jewish synagogues, Friends Meeting, Unitarian Fellowships. And so I think that it is, it's America.
But I can say, I'm not hearing the other side. I'm not hearing it at all.
As my great-grandfather was a slave, it was the me, that there was a close relationship between what happened in the back of the underground we were in the pre-Civil War days and what we're now doing in the sanctuary movement for the time.
We have some Austinians being the head of the country in Guatemala, and certainly represented one form of expression of the faith, and I think I am concerned to say I think my Christian faith leads me in a different direction.
I feel that the news is probably distorted a lot of times. How do we know what the situation is?
The sanctuary movement has, and many other churches, and it looks like it will here, provide a way for people to do something significant and relate this to the reality in a different way.
Witness for Peace. Their touch with life in Central America left them full of questions rather than answers, but they encouraged others to move more quickly toward bringing a refugee family here. In a welcoming service for the Gomez's, Maria Teresa and her brother Pedro performed a Guatemalan dance. Pedro read one of his poems about a young girl who committed suicide after her father's arrest. Believing him killed, she would join him in heaven. The father was later released to be present at his daughter's funeral. Another brother, Joaquin, used the family in his Spanish play, The Man Who Became a Dog. Its theme, the collapse of human dignity under repression, transcended the language barrier.
And in the
Joaquin's testimony of the assassination of opposition leaders in Guatemala brought some to tears.
Made by the INS is this, the entire sanctuary caravan's political grandstand. What we say is one of those who helped plan the caravan and participated fully in the length of the caravan, that I don't think that is the case. The caravan began in Phoenix, which was the scene of the pretrial hearings. And it is precisely because we felt that the trial of our 12 indicted brothers and sisters in Phoenix was stacked against us. That is, the defense cannot present to the jury our religious motivation. We cannot present to the jury the international law. We cannot present to the jury the facts of what's happening in Central America. We have no defense. Therefore, part of the idea of the caravan was to bring to the American people, the real jury in this case, the story of sanctuary and the story of the plight of Salvadoran and Guatemalan refugees. And that's why we had this caravan stopping at 40 cities across the United States.
I do not consider it a political point at all because I support the administration's policy in Central America. But I also support the sanctuary movement. Sanctuary, as far as I'm concerned, it's a simple humane point that people who are in danger of losing their lives are in danger of being sent back to the same spot where they're apt to be murdered. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't think there's any question about it. I think the church should afford sanctuary to such individuals. And that consideration in my mind is quite aside from my feelings about the political realities in Central America.
It's a Chinese proverb that I go back to often in helping me understand the implications of giving aid to refugees, which is the story of a person who lived along the side of a river, and there were wounded people flowing down the river again and again, and he would pull them out and give them aid and heal their wounds year after year. And finally, one day, decided to go up the river to see what was causing their wounds. That, to me, is the implication of the sanctuary movement politically.
I think that is why I say it here. There's no doubt, I think in many of our minds, that in El Salvador and Guatemala there are scenes of terror, oppression, and persecution. Now the question, I think, in your mind, is what the United States contributes to that. And that's where you and I differ. You say we don't, I think, and I say we do.
One of the reasons I'm anxious that our sanctuary program not be a political program is that I think that's what we're accusing the government of doing, that they're turning the immigration policy into a political policy by not allowing into our country people who are running away from persecution by right-wing governments. So that I don't want to make you the same thing you're doing. I mean, our policy is based on the community.
But that's exactly the point. 2 points. One, the implication of that statement, that criticism, is that politics somehow breeds an issue. Politics means the will of the people. It's the involvement of the people making decisions. The sanctuary movement hasn't made immigration a political issue, but the INS and the executive branch of the government at this point has. It has said that we are not going to admit into asylum, political asylum, certain people from countries which have certain kinds of governments. That is a political decision and a political action. And it means that if people in this country expressing some kind of will as a group, a political will, if these people say even that we are going to offer humanitarian assistance, they are, as you just were, implicitly critical of the U.S. government's policy, at least with regard to immigration policy.
I don't find the sanctuary movement as a particularly effective way of either of opposing policies or not supporting the policy in Central America. I think the power in our country today is intolerance. The only reason I'm supporting the sanctuary movement is because of the community considerations. I came here today to say that, you know, and to say at the same time that we support the administration's policy in Central America.
And I do think that the sanctuary movement is a way of addressing Congress, because I think we rouse public opinion. I think one of the experiences that I've heard about from people who traveled on the caravan was how many people they met across the country in churches, church after church, who were supportive or at least curious about what was happening to these people in Central America, particularly to this Guatemalan that's come to our church. And I think that outpouring of concerned people says a lot to me, and I would hope that it says a lot to our representative.
I agree with you, and I agree with Laura's point about there's something implicit in our action which is critical to immigration service policy. I certainly do agree with that. Although I make a distinction too between the policy of a major agency of government like that and the policy of the elected leaders.
At least when I was in Nicaragua, I was more concerned about what our government was doing there than I was about the Sandinista government. I had mixed feelings about it. I didn't know that much about it. I felt I knew more about my own government and had more of a stake in feelings for criticizing it, strengthening it, doing whatever.
Of course it's a political action, but how political it will be determined by what we do at the University Church. And that, the thing I guess specific that I'm concerned about is that I know that this family was chosen for their ability to be before the public and present ideas and be persuasive, and they went through a screening process right at the border to choose families for sanctuary. And so they've been chosen purposefully to carry out political objectives. I hope that University Church will see that this family is not used to further the political objectives of the organizers of the sanctuary movement. And this is a concern of mine.
The problems and necessary corrective.
So you have like to start using people if the objectives are all right.
No, that's not the way to put it. But I think the point is, do the people that are doing quotes used that are involved in themselves, and we share a common understanding, a common analysis of the problems we're facing and the implications of our government in these times, and can we together articulate a point of view which is educational, which is political education, either way we do.
Well, I think this is a far step from my understanding of the origin of the sanctuary movement. Rather than pulling people out of it, the political fray, we are thrusting them up in front of people and using them to carry out political objectives and not following the tradition of the sanctuary movement.
And it's important to realize that this family not only as well. They wanted to come into sanctuary, and one was a wants an opportunity to perform a public ministry, and he sees it as a ministry to be able to talk about how his what his life experiences have been in his own country and how he's come here and how his very activity in religious communities in Guatemala brought persecution upon him. And I think it's important that we allow him to tell his own story. And that the only way that I see presently that he can tell this story is by being sponsored by the church. He doesn't have the opportunity, if he's not in sanctuary, to speak openly about who he is and the story of his family.
I think too, the person that organizes these speaking engagements and the meetings and the rallies that he would speak at has a the ability to influence people and a lot of sway in all of this. And I hope that I don't know who we do in this. Will the Chicago Religious Task Force be organizing?
We won't be doing this. So let's be really clear about this. The Disciples of Christ as a denomination, the United Church of Christ as a denomination, the Presbyterian Church, the Episcopal Church, the Methodist Church, at the very highest level, have supported fully the sanctuary meeting. Furthermore, they have gone on record, these denominations, and say our U.S. policy in Central America is ill-advised, it is illegal, and clearly it is immoral. And so we know what we're doing when we are criticizing, and we have the right to criticize our government's policy as a church. I think there is a coalescence of interests here, both to speak out on behalf not only of the freedom of the church, but the church's ministry to the poor, and also at the same time to share our concern about a direction of U.S. policy, which is
there's certainly a
coalition
of political interests.
The Central American politics and religion are not separate.
Let's be very careful. I think, Andy, your basic concern is that you don't want to be manipulated.
Our family.
You don't want to be manipulated. You don't want the family to be manipulated. And you don't want the church to be manipulated. I hear that in everything you're saying. And your fear is that the Chicago Religious Task Force and the people who are doing screening of the families have a distinct political opinion, and they will manipulate the movement according to their desires politically. I think that was a real danger, and I think that when it became a concern to you, it was a danger that one political viewpoint would take over the movement. And I think what happened was that within a sanctuary movement, the churches said, we are the ones doing this ministry, we are developing our positions, we're the ones in control of this.
I got a whole minute of that rock, don't you see? I got a whole minute of that rock, don't you see? Way between the earth and the sky, but I heard my Savior cry. You better get a whole minute of that rock, don't you see? Lazarus, poor as I, don't you see? Poor old Lazarus, poor as I, don't you see? Poor old Lazarus is poor as I. When he died, he got nothing on us. You better get a whole bit of that rock.
Thank you.
Lord welcomes new members with the words, "You are one of us."
He knows what I'm saying.
Also, still the very suffers. Yet, he knows through the things. Also, still the very suffers.
Defenses, if possible, are being presented, for example, in the
Guatemalans are not illegally present in the United States, that under U.S. law, the Refugee Act of 1980, and under international law treaties that the United States has signed, they are lawfully entitled to be here, and therefore assistance given to them is not prosecutable under the harboring and transporting section. In other words, the language of the law says that you must be providing assistance to persons unlawfully present in the United States. Yeah. If these people are not here in violation of the law, then there's no criminal lawyer.
I'm not, as a person of Christian conscience, I'm willing, if the need be, to violate laws, but I just don't want to violate them flagrantly. And I think in this case, then, I would be within the general understanding to see myself as acting at least legally according to my insights and my interpretation of the law. Would that be fair?
I think that there's definitely support for that position. And you can also turn to beyond U.S. statutory law, there's also international law that the United States has obeyed and has even created in other contexts. For example, looking at the Nuremberg example is an interesting example. The principles which came out of the Nuremberg tribunals basically established the principle that it's the duty of civilians and natives and citizens of a country to prevent their country from engaging in illegal and inhumane activities. So, for example, if the church were to take a position that the Justice Department's deportation of Salvadorans and Guatemalans back to their home country is illegal because it's inhumane because it's sending those people back to their deaths, then you have a duty under the principles established at Nuremberg, where the United States is one of the prosecuting authorities, to prevent your government from doing it.
Okay, so we may be in conflict with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, or we may be in conflict with one interpretation of our government, but we may be fully within international law.
Yeah, and that decision will be made by a jury.
So that has to come into a court, that has to come into a case. And then it was tried by a court and a jury, that then the decision is made.
Okay.
The Gomez's were with us until December, right until Christmas time. They were very active in terms of speaking engagements and in terms of leading Bible study within our church. One of the gifts of the Gomez family was their firm commitment to a public ministry. I mean, it's very, very clear. I mean, I think it came out here, and how important the Bible was in their lives and how they wanted to present, how they saw things through their eyes and through the eyes of how they read the Bible, and brought that to us, especially Maria. They left our congregation in December and are now in sanctuary in Hartford, Connecticut with the Friends congregation there. Maria's brothers, if you remember at the beginning of the film, Joaquin and Pedro, went on to Northampton, Massachusetts. They stopped in Chicago, and that welcoming ceremony with the dancing and things with the whole family. They're all performers with singing and dancing and poetry and all sorts of things. And actually, I was very surprised when I saw at the welcoming, because I thought it's just awful that Pedro and Joaquin are leaving. I mean, this is a real troop we've got here. And so they were reunited, actually, now. They're back on the East Coast. I mean, they're very close together. And apparently Maria's father is now there in the vicinity, too. And she worried much of the time about his health. And somehow he was gotten to, Massachusetts. So that the family is pretty well intact, as I understand it now. We were left, you might say, in December. We didn't really know that was going to happen. We didn't know how long the Gomez's would be with us. And as a matter of fact, even when they came in July, we even thought we had this idea that maybe they would even just be with us maybe 5 or 6 weeks, and then maybe just stay in the Hispanic community in Chicago. It just kind of blend in. And of course, the reality of that was, of course, that didn't happen, and clearly they didn't want to be in the Hispanic community in Chicago. They felt more threatened to be there. They felt that they would be turned in by other, what they call Guatemalan thugs, or that they could be just picked up. And of course, I mean, just standing at the bus corner or something like that. So in some ways, I mean, they certainly wanted to stay in a non-Hispanic neighborhood, which we were. And so, I mean, that was kind of a reality. So the fact is, we never knew how long they were going to stay. And the fact that they did stay with us 6 months, it was a very rich 6 months. We were a little upset when they did leave, because it did seem to happen all of a sudden, and we didn't really know that was necessarily on their minds, although it makes a whole lot of sense that the family did want to be together. And it was even said in this film, they expected when her brothers came out, that their family would be together. They wanted to make sure that did happen.
Nevertheless, we felt betrayed by the situation, and I think it's typical. You're doing a good deed, and you don't want to stop doing the good deed. And if it's taken up, you can understand it. I always said, let's take it as a gift. We don't have to pay all that money and to take care of them. Now, you know, there are a lot of ambiguities about the decision. At least welcome it.
But, I don't know.
We never discussed that I know of.
As to say, one of the things that they really did want to do, I mean, they really did believe that they had a ministry, all that was said there is really quite true of how they viewed themselves, that they were in a public ministry supported by a church, now in Hartford by that church, to tell the United States people their story. So they didn't want it. They weren't just here to get out of a situation, but they wanted to really do.
But you have to see this action on the part of the church in the long-term context of our commitment to Central America. And since they have gone, you can say better than I can what's happened.
Well, just briefly, and then Ellen, I'll pick up on you. Since they have left, two of us went to Guatemala as a result of the family being there to get more of a feel of the country that they had to leave. And to me, that was a great gift. I think Bible study has just come to, it's not just an incredible thing, but for me and for several other people, the quality of Bible study and even having Bible study, which is not necessarily a UCC Disciples of Christ thing that they do very often, is have Bible study. And I think the result of Central America activities and the Gomez's has it's increased a great deal and very much a part of our church life now, much more than it ever was. We have a Monday night, every Monday night now, we have a vigil for Central America, a Bible study, and then program our meeting around Central America. And that's just every week.
How was that triggered, Sarah?
The meeting, or the Monday night? Well, it's again evolved in some ways from the discussions through to having the Gomez's there to our going to two of us going to Guatemala. And one of the other person that went to Guatemala said, I think we ought to have a Monday night vigil. Or a vigil, and we decided on Monday night.
Of course,
the sanctuary committee had been meeting every other week or something anyway. I mean, you know, when with the Gomez family, I mean, plans had to be made. And of course, we were plugging into whatever Pledge of Resistance activities were happening and letter writing and a variety of events around Central America that were going on. So we just combined the meetings that we were already having, but it was extended because we have a Southside task force on Central America. So it's also not just members in our church, but other people on the South Side that have an interest in Central America and want to plug in somewhere. So that has also been created too.
It's a very long, complex, involved story. Dan Dale, who was the first person you saw, really organized Sanctuary and provided many of the materials for the Sanctuary movement coming out of the Chicago Religious Task Force. He got me on the Chicago Religious Task Force. And out of that, all kinds of things happened, and partly this activity in the church. And then John Fish, you saw, after he got back from Nicaragua, was a new person. He's an ordained Presbyterian minister who works with Jody and Ingrid in the Associated College of the Midwest, Chicago Urban Studies program. And he'd never come into his calling as a minister, although he'd been a minister for a while. And all of a sudden, you know the story, he blossomed. He took half-time work. He is so deeply involved in it. And I think that's one of the joys for me as the kind of behind-the-scenes pusher and persuader, to see him emerge and see Sarah emerge and see the minister's wife. The minister's wife is such an effective minister without having any portfolio. John is a minister without having a portfolio. Carl Snyder is a minister. He's kind of the focus for a Tuesday morning group. Every Tuesday morning at 7:45, we meet and discuss the whole thrust of our church in terms of foreign policy and kind of orchestrate it a little and talk about it and support each other. And one of the persons in the where we had the group wrote a book on nuclear weapons coming out of our group. I asked him to do some 15 pages for Jesse, and the result was, and that all came out of this group in our church. I can't overemphasize.
Sounds like a ferment.
It's a ferment that has been taking place. And the criticism of the Chicago Religious Task Force by Andy Carter, who's in our community, and who's really has a problem with Dan Dale. It's a long-standing problem, and I'm in the middle of that discussion, that antagonism. Partly his antagonism to our whole sanctuary is an antagonism against Dan Dale. And you've got to understand, you know, how those things work out. The Chicago Religious Task Force has some staff. I actually didn't, I withdrew after a while, partly because I'm too busy. We now have another member of our group that's in the Chicago Religious Task Force. So there's a whole lot of ferment. But all of this came out of, really out of my decision, covenanting with the our community, our intentional community, to attend to foreign policy. And our minister permitted it. He's a kind of enabling minister. And he let the lay people, and we got a lot of lay people, they're there. They're there in every church, I suspect, maybe not as much as in ours. The narrator of this is the dean of the faculty at McCormick, the woman who did it is his wife. We have a lot of resources. We have a Unitarian Meadville Seminary professor in our Tuesday morning group. I mean, we've attracted, there's just a life surge there, and I may be over-enthusiastic because I'm connected with it, but I think it's a fact. It has happened, and people have just been given life and spirit because we attended to something long enough, concentrated enough, and thought about practical ways of relating to it and not just head trips. And we're now in the process of getting sister churches in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua. I'm not quite sure which one will emerge, but we're working on that. But, you know, it's just our church. It may not be possible for other churches to. But what we're saying, I think, is that it can happen. If you have just a few people who decide they'll give time and energy to it. And it does take some time and energy and leadership.
One of the major questions in the film seems to me to be one of the major questions in the sanctuary movement as a whole, which is the tension between the politics of sanctuary. Is it in fact a political movement in opposition to U.S. policy in Central America versus the sort of serving the individual thrust of the sanctuary movement? These are individuals in trouble. Let's do our Christian duty and help them. The film makes it seem like neither of those two sides won in your church, that they're both still there, and that the discussion, therefore, is probably ongoing. Is that an accurate reading of where you are on that?
I don't know that it's ongoing. I mean, we continue. 20 members of our church will show up at a demonstration with the church banner. The church board didn't vote to take the banner, but somehow it shows up. You know, there's just a widening group of people who are involved, and I don't think we have ever had to face the issue of doing what we're doing seriously from the people who are raising questions here. May come later, we continue to do things. We don't involve the church as a church, although taking the banner you say might. But generally speaking, we don't involve the church as a church. We are the foreign policy group, or we are the sanctuary committee. We're a part of the church. One of our problems is to get more and more people involved. I think there's a sense in which we probably have 30 people in the church vitally concerned with Central America, vitally concerned and active in some way. The question is how you move on.
Yeah, wait, back and in front.
I guess as a Canadian, I find it encouraging that, you know, this has happened within the last year. As we look with a great deal of sorrow on the U.S. foreign policy, as we think, and our church has sponsored two refugee families that have moved through the sanctuary movement up into Canada. And I guess and working with those refugee families and trying to get them to adjust to a very, very different country from what they used to. And we don't have a large Hispanic community growing because of this. though they do have a tendency to isolate themselves because they, of their fears of somehow it will get back and affect the families that are back home. And so it tends to be a very lonely time sometimes for them because they are, they set themselves into an isolated situation and a very cultural shock kind of thing.
Yeah,
but I guess to me it's exciting to find out that there are, it's, you know, there's a growing and it's not what we consider a blindness.
I think we're about to think about another family, but before we do, I think we ought to have a half a dozen people who speak Spanish. I mean, probably the imperative, the call right now in our church, if we're serious about this, is for people to learn Spanish so that there can be communication from the church. We've always had interpreters. We had one in the church and she left. Then it, always people outside. But somehow, if you're going to take people seriously, start your kids. Our son started Spanish, what, first grade? I'm sure it was the result of this. And we chose a school, actually, where language started in the first grade.
Yes, sir.
I heard two things. First thing I heard was that the pastor or the clergy person in the congregation was an enabler for this to happen. But I also heard that it became something separate from the church, or when you go to a protest, you're not representing the church, or how does that happen? How do you get a clergy person to be, to let that happen, to enable that to happen?
Well, I think there's an atmosphere that things spin off. But that doesn't mean it's separate. I mean, all our meetings and our vigils and everything are at the church. It doesn't necessarily mean that the minister thinks he has to be there and run it. And that not everybody else in the church, I mean, we don't have to have 100% of the church congregation there at a demonstration or at whatever other event. That's the way I
look
at it.
I guess my real question is, if a clergy person does not want to be that enabler, can that still happen within the congregation?
Very difficult. One of the reasons I went to this church is I felt we had two ministers then who that I knew very well, one woman, one man. I felt both of them were enablers of the intentional Christian community, which we were interested in. And in that case, Harvey Lord, our minister, our senior minister, took the lead. He really was for it, and without him, we never would have. All kinds of things were necessary.
Well,
in this case, he dragged his feet. But when push came to shove, he was there, and he didn't say no. He just saw it in part, and he's very realistic, as a big administrative added burden. All the finances go through the church. Xeroxing, mimeographing, meetings, and we have just all kinds of stuff going. So it's understandable.
I'd like to speak to that.
Yeah.
My wife and I have been working in this ever since we went to Nicaragua, and we put on a class, a long study session using Sojourner's Crucible of Hope, and we have maybe 6 to 8 people in our class. At the same time, the pastor would have 50 people in his class. And what this kind of angered me, that if that's a competition, I mean, what really should be happening is the pastor ought to be at least presenting or encouraging or at least saying, well, I'm not going to have a competing class while this session's in place so that more of you will take part in it. So really, we haven't really had the support of the professional, the pastor in this effort. So it's always been... So we haven't had the blessing of many, many people in the congregation that are supporting that movement. So it's been very difficult to get any action going with just a few people.
So yeah.
I'm saying you need support. You need somebody to take the risk.
I just wondered if anybody had any other experience with that.
I'm just curious, how large is your congregation?
200?
200, 225, something like that.
It's not large, and it's a very transient population with all the universities and seminaries that we're right in the midst of. So,
but the membership, core is not there's a substantial membership.
We've had people now join the church because of our Central America activities. I don't know of anybody that's left because of them. They've left because they moved. But as far as I know,
we don't know.
I mean, at least they've been very quiet. They certainly haven't been very vocal. But I can't think of anybody that's left because of it.